Please stand by. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the IBM Storage Talk SBC version 4.3 update conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to your host, Mr. Bill Wiegand. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Melody. And good day, everyone, and welcome to the second in the five-part series. Today, we're going to focus on version 4.3, the updates, the key items in there being VDIS mirroring and space-efficient VDIS. And then we'll cover some of the other announcements that were made when 4.3 came out in June of this year. So let's go ahead and go to the next chart, chart 2. This is our agenda for the day. We'll kind of get an overview of the anchor items, get into depth on how space-efficient VDIS work. We'll also take a look at space-efficient flash copy, which is a byproduct of having space-efficient VDIS. Then we'll take a look at VDIS mirroring in depth as well. And then also in 4.3, there were some additional enhancements we'll go into, some changes in the licensing of the SVC Advanced Copy Services that are important to understand, along with some other miscellaneous information that we'll cover, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers. So let's go ahead and get started. Go to Chart 3. And let's take a look at some of the two anchor items in version 4.3, primarily space-efficient VDIS. This is what is known in the industry as thin provisioning or over-allocation, as your customers may be talking about that. It gives you the ability to present volumes to your host that don't have the exact or the actually dedicated physical storage available for those. So we'll get into depth of how that works and how you can use that in your environments. We'll also take a look at space-efficient flash copy. There's really no changes in flash copy itself, except now we can use space-efficient VDIS for both the source and the target, and how can that help a customer. We'll take a look at VDIS mirroring, which allows us to have two copies of a VDIS. There is just one VDIS, but two copies of the data, so pointers to two controllers is typically the idea, so that if one controller fails, the other can continue. It also offers some very nice capabilities in for migration of data and ways to move data around within your SVC over and above what you can do today with the migration capabilities in the SVC today. And then we'll also look at just kind of here at this fourth bullet, where these two functions fit, if you will, in the I/O stack within the SVC. We've put them both below the cache, so again, the cache can filter out and help provide the performance that we need, because these new functions do take some CPU processing. There is some extra overhead for those. But again, it should be masked by the ability to cache the information, the data, and the writes from the host, and we do these things under the covers. Now, we've put VDIS mirroring under the flash copy component in the I/O stack so that we can actually use flash copy we can use the mirroring function is irrelevant to the flash copy, because again, we're doing it at the VDisk level, so we don't have to worry about the two different copies that may be there. We have put space efficient VDisk below flash copy so that we can actually use the flash copy with those and provide space efficiency. Space efficient VDisk function sits below the VDisk mirroring so that I can actually have one copy could be space efficient, another copy of a VDIS could be fully allocated. So again, that's where they sit in the I/O stack, and for various reasons to allow us to utilize them in the most efficient way. So let's go ahead and go on to the next chart, chart 4. Some terminology that we need to understand before we get into space efficient VDIS: virtual capacity. This is what the host sees. And so today, as you create a 10 gigabyte VDIS to give to a host, that's 10 gigabyte is the virtual capacity. That's no different with space-efficient VDIS as it is today with fully allocated VDIS. Real capacity is the amount of the number of extents that we've pre-allocated to a space-efficient VDIS. Now, today in a fully allocated, when you allocate 10 gigabytes of virtual capacity to give to a host, you've also allocated 10 gigabytes of real capacity on the disk storage. And those extents are consumed even if you never put any data out there on them. So that, in a fully allocated, the way we're used to VDIS today, the virtual capacity and the real capacity are the same thing. With space-efficient VDIS, the real capacity could be something less than the virtual capacity. used capacity is actually the amount of that real capacity that we've pre-allocated, pre-reserved, if you will, for the VDisk to be able to grow up to that virtual capacity that the host has seen. The used capacity is just the real capacity actually that has data allocated on it. And we'll take more deeper look at how all that works as we go on. Then the free capacity is how much of the real capacity is still available to store data. So the difference between real capacity and used capacity is your free capacity. And you'll see all these as new items on a lot of the CLI commands for listing VDisk and looking at VDisk, as well as when you look through the GUI, you'll see these same types of information. And then there's another one, contingency capacity. And this is the difference between the real and the used capacity that the SVC tries to maintain as available space. And this is really used on Space Efficient VDisk when you use the auto-expand, which we'll talk more about as well. And auto-expand is probably the way most customers are going to use Space Efficient VDisk. It allows the VDisk to grow, the real capacity, to grow up to the virtual capacity, which is what you probably want customers to do, but you don't have to set it up that way. And we'll go into more depth on that in the next few charts. So let's go ahead and go to chart 5 and take a look at this. In this particular chart, we still have our host on the left side. We have our virtual capacity. This is what the host sees. So this might be 10 gigabytes. But you'll notice the real capacity, we've maybe only allocated a couple of extents, maybe just a gigabyte of real capacity on the back end storage. And as you can kind of see by the blue color, we've only allocated a certain amount of that with real data at this time. And the way we keep track of this is with a directory, a B-tree directory, that knows where the data really is, because the logical block addresses may be scattered all over the virtual capacity, but we coalesce all of that data onto a smaller area on the real capacity to, again, save space, save physical disk space on the back end. So, again, this directory map is important. It has the location of the real addresses, and it does consume some space on the actual real capacity, and we'll talk about that a little bit, too, because there is some the directory structure itself. So let's go ahead and go to the next chart, chart 6. Here's kind of an example of what we're talking about. You specify the virtual capacity that the host is going to see. So in this case, our virtual capacity is 2 gigabytes. That's logical block address 0 through what it says there is. That will be a logical block address maximum for that 2 gigabytes. The VDisk, according to the host, thinks there's 2 gigabytes that he can write to. But really, under the covers, we've only allocated or pre-reserved 1 gigabyte of real physical space. We wouldn't even have to do that if we didn't want to, but we think it's going to grow to at least 1 gigabyte. So in this particular example, we've pre-reserved 1 gig, basically, if they were 512 meg extents that we were using for our managed disk group, we would pre-reserve 2 extents for that virtual disk to be able to use. So let's go ahead and go to the next chart, chart 7. Now we have some host write IOs that come into the VDisk, and you can see the dark stripes there. We have some writes to that virtual capacity at the host side. We then allocate off of the real capacity, we actually allocate real physical space and write data into it as we go. So in this particular case, the real capacity is used up by allocating a grain. The grain size when you're doing space-efficient VDisk, when you first create them, gives you the option to create them at 32, 64, 128, or 256 kilobytes. The default is 32K, and what this does is how much of that real capacity we actually use when we write an I.O. So the smallest amount that we will consume is 32 kilobytes. Even if we only write 4K of data, we're going to allocate 32K of that real capacity and really use that space, and it'll show up as used capacity at that point in time. The rest of that 32K after a 4K write to it is available to be written to later as more data is written. And since it's already allocated, there's less work that SVC needs to do to write data into that 32K. So again, as we did this, we're also making an entry into the B-tree directory. That B-tree directory does use capacity. It's less than 1% of the used capacity, so it's very minimal, but that is kept with the Space Vision VDIS, that data, virtual to real mapping is stored on the real capacity, so it does consume some of that space. So let's go ahead here. In this particular example, we see the 2 gig and the 1 gig. We've used 200 meg, which means we have a free capacity of 800 meg, if you remember our definitions then. If we go to the next chart, now we've written some more data. If the used capacity reaches the real capacity that we set by default, the SVC will notify the end users either via SMP traps or emails that, hey, we're nearing or we are at 80% or whatever setting they set, the default being 80% of capacity. So once we get up to 800 megabytes of that 1 gigabyte real capacity, we'll alert people that we're running out of physical space to store this data. Depending on whether you have auto expand set on or not, will determine what happens if you do run out of space. So we'll talk about that as we go forward. And again, the SVC helps you avoid exhausting the space by various warnings and things that we're monitoring to make let the customer know when he's going to run out of capacity, and possibly a VDIS will go offline because it won't be able to satisfy the write request from the application. So if we go to the next chart, sort of how is space allocated? This is chart 9. As we mentioned, space is only allocated when data is first written. So even though we have a real capacity pre-reserved, we can actually take that away if we want to. It's only once we start writing data, these allocation units, again, the default being 32K, that we consume space. Now, that space currently in this implementation of Space Efficient VDIS is not deallocated. So if we remove all the data off a 32K grain, we don't remove that grain from allocation and put it back into the free pool, if you will. That would require what we call zero detect to notice that there is no data in there. And again, the application, when it deletes files or whatever, would have to write zeros in there so that we can do that. Most don't today, so there's not a real good use for deallocation. So we'll just have to kind of watch that space as things go forward. So today, once we allocate 32K, we don't take it back, even if there's no data in it. You can choose your granularity when you set these things up. You may want to look at 256K bytes. We have done some testing in very large environments, lots of disks, that it looks like the grain size being set at 256 is better than 32K in some situations. It does use more space, so you have to weigh that against as a customer trying to get maximum least utilization possible, or is he looking for possibly the best performance with space-efficient VDIS. So those are your trade-offs there. Once you set, you can't change that, so it is takes some planning to decide what you're going to do when you're using space-efficient VDIS. When we first allocate it, we always format it as part of we go, so there is not a requirement to format a space-efficient VDIS. Actually, if you make the choice in the SVC, it will just ignore it because we format as we go along. And again, as we said, smaller granularity than 30K, you're going to save more space, but there's going to be a little bit more work to track that, and more your B-tree is going to be bigger to search through and things like that, so it may be beneficial to bump up to the higher 256K grain size in some cases. We go to the next chart, chart 10. Here's kind of what happens when writes and reads come into a space-efficient VDIS. If you're going to write to an unallocated region, that means we haven't allocated a 32, 64, 128, or 256 grain. First, we have to look in the directory to see if it's been allocated, and we find out, no, it hasn't. So SVC goes out. It may even have to grab more space, grab another extent out of the managed disk group to grow the real capacity if he's out of space for the real capacity. But assuming the real capacity is there, he's going to go out and allocate a grain. He's going to write that 4K in there, and while he's doing that, he'll also format the rest of that 32K or whatever size grain that you're using. Now, if a write comes into an allocated region, again, so if we've now allocated that 32K and we've used that space and we've only written 4K of real data into there, and another write comes into that same logical block address range, then we'll just write the data into that 32K. We won't have to allocate another unit. Again, we do have to do a directory lookup to see if it's allocated, but if it has been allocated, then we just write the data. If we're doing a read to an allocated region, again, we look in the directory. We see that, yes, this data is out there and it's in this directory. We then get redirected to go read that data from the appropriate spot on the physical disk. Now, an unusual thing that shouldn't really happen, but if it would, just for data integrity, if an application would try to read to a region of disk that he has never written to before, this would be something really wrong with the application. We will guarantee that zeros are returned back to an application if he tries to read from a location that has not been written to at this point in time. So that's kind of how the IOs come in, and what it does is you can see every read and every write does have to look in this directory, so there is overhead associated with using space-efficient VDIS, and we'll talk about that on a performance chart coming up in a little bit. So let's go ahead and go to chart 11. In this particular case, how do we create space-efficient VDIS? Well, this you can do now through the GUI or through the CLI. There's a lot more options if you start looking at the make VDIS commands for setting up space-efficient VDIS as well as VDIS mirroring. So you're going to see lots of new options there. And the new wizard or the wizard in the SVC GUI will walk you through all the different options that you have when you want to create one. But basically, you're going to probably do it through the GUI. You're going to select that you want it to be a space-efficient VDIS, and then it'll walk you through the different options. A couple of the options you have are you have to pick what operating mode that you want the space-efficient VDIS to work in. One of the modes is auto-expand, which says if I want to, I don't really want to babysit all of these VDIS, so if I'm going to create 10 gigabyte VDIS to give to an application and I'm only going to give them, let's say, 5 gigabyte of real capacity out of the managed disk group, when it gets up to using up that 5 gigabytes, I want it to automatically go out and get more extents out of the managed disk group and let it grow up to the 10 gigabyte virtual capacity without my intervention. Now, that can be a good thing and it can be a bad thing. The good thing is I don't have to monitor it. I'll just let it grow up to the virtual capacity, which is all the host sees anyway, and everything's fine. The downside is if I do that and I have some misbehaving applications that maybe use up all the virtual capacity, all the real capacity, and it grows it up to that size, and that's more than I have physical storage, then obviously I could run out of physical storage as well. So, again, you have to monitor these things. If you have an environment that you don't want them to auto-expand and I want to be notified when I need to allocate more real capacity to grow it up to the virtual capacity, then you can also set your VDisk up that way as well. Fortunately, you can dynamically change it from auto to non-auto and vice versa, so you can start one way and change it to another way if you so desire. Go to the next chart, chart 12. Let's take a look at non-auto-expand VDisk. So you specify a virtual and a real capacity. So again, if we said 10 gigabyte was the virtual and 5 gigabyte was the real, once we get up to 80% of that real capacity, that would be 4 gigabytes, we're going to get a warning by default to the end users or the administrators or and send an SNMP trap as well to say, hey, we're getting close, we're up to 80% of the utilization, somebody needs to take a look at this or you're eventually going to run out of space. So this threshold can be changed if so desired, but again, it's designed, the 80% is the default, and again, this may be a case where you'd want to use this when you want to kind of monitor the usage maybe for your test development environment so that they can't keep stealing, if you will, disk space any way they want to, which could impact the production environment if you have a customer that's kind of sharing environment. So you might want to give them just manual control of that so they have to go allocate more space and get permission to do that. So that might be one use for non-auto-expand VDIS. If we go to the next chart, chart 13, I really think most customers would use auto-expand because if you have hundreds of VDIS, you don't want to be being alerted every time one starts to get low on space. You would want the system to automatically expand it up to the virtual capacity, which is what the host sees, and give you a warning maybe when the managed disk group is getting low on overall space, and that we can also do, which we'll talk about. But again, I believe most folks will use auto-expand, so we automatically grow. If we have that 10 gig VDIS that the host sees and we have 5 gig of real capacity pre-allocated ahead of time, as we use up that 5 gig of real capacity and we need more real capacity, we just go out and automatically get more extents out of the managed disk group, grow the real capacity up to the maximum, which is the virtual capacity. Now, this contingency capacity that we talked about earlier, this is where this comes into play with auto-expand VDIS. So let's take a little bit different example. Let's say we created a 50 gig VDIS, and we pre-reserved by setting the real capacity to 10 gigabytes. And now as we start growing, we have auto expand on, we're writing data. As we get up to and start writing data to this particular VDisk, the contingency capacity, what SVC tries to do is maintain this 10 gigabyte real capacity of free space, if you will. So what happens is I start writing, let's say I write 2 gigabytes of data to this VDisk, the real capacity will automatically grow to 12 gigabytes. And the reason is we're trying to maintain that 10 gigabyte contingency buffer, if you will. So as we keep growing and growing, we're always going to try to keep basically 10 gigabytes of free space available and pre-reserved out of the managed disk group, so that if we did run out of extents in the managed disk group, we still have this 10 gig buffer that's already been pre-reserved for this VDisk, so he's going to not run out of space immediately. In some cases, if you don't have this, you may next time you need to grab an extent just to write the next few bytes of data, you're going to run out of real capacity to do that with. So that on some of your applications that are most important, you may want to set this real capacity, this contingency buffer with auto expand, such that the last VDisk will go offline if you would run out of physical storage in your entire system, have this buffer that can keep things running for a while until you can get more space allocated and available to the SVC cluster. So if we go to the next chart, chart 14, the VDisk warning threshold. This is on your space-efficient VDisk. We've talked about this before. It's typically designed to work with non-auto expand, so that once we start to fill up a VDisk, reaching that 80% of the real capacity, then at that point in time we notify someone that we're running out of space. Now, if you have auto expand on, this VDisk warning, basically since auto expand says I'll just grow the real capacity up to the virtual capacity, I'll just notify you when you get to 80% of the virtual capacity that you're starting to run out of space. So again, this is they just behave a little bit differently depending on whether you're using auto expand or non-auto expand. The real message and warning that you're probably most interested in, because again, I believe folks are going to use auto expand most of their VDisk, is when we go to chart 15, and this is the managed disk group warning threshold. So now in here we have a threshold that says, hey, we've allocated extents to the real capacity on these space-efficient VDisks, as well as maybe to regularly fully allocated VDisks. And so we only have so much free space left in the managed disk group. And so we can set warnings up there to indicate to the storage administrator that, hey, we're running out of physical storage on this managed disk group. We need to either allocate some more storage or do something, move some VDisk from one managed disk group to another or whatever it may be, to make sure that we don't run out of space. So we try all possible ways we can in the SVC when using space-efficient VDisk to make sure the customers are aware of when they're running out of physical storage. So we go to the next chart, chart 16. What happens if we do run out of space? The way this works in SVC today is if you have space-efficient VDisk and it runs out of space, we will take that VDisk offline. We don't change it into read-only, which some folks might expect. We've had some input back from customers that they'd prefer these only go to read-only because then they could possibly delete some space on their file systems to fix the problem at the application side. In some of our testing development made the decision to take the VDisk offline. So in that particular case, now we've pretty much taken them away from the application, and the application is going to have issue with that. But that is what happens. We give you all kinds of warnings to let you know that it's getting close to out of space, so you do have to monitor it. But if we do run out of space, we take them offline at this point in time. If it's a non-auto expand VDisk, and now you've actually run out of real capacity, your virtual capacity, again, might have been 2 gigabytes, but you had 1 gig of real, and the application thinks I got 2 gig. In reality, with non-auto expand, you ran out of space when you got to the 1 gig real capacity setting. So you would have to go in and allocate more real capacity to grow it up to the virtual capacity or something like that to get that VDisk back online. If you've got auto expand and we've literally run out of space in the managed disk group, you could either add more MDisk to the MDisk group, or you can actually migrate that VDisk from one MDisk group to another, even though it's offline, and move it over to another managed disk group where there's more space. Again, you're going to want to use these warning thresholds to help give advance notice of conditions where you're going to be running out of space. So we provide those as email alerts, as SNMP traps, again, to help the customer manage this type of environment. We go to the next chart, which is space efficient performance. I won't go through all of this, but I wanted to give you some ideas of the information we've got back from development and testing with space-efficient VDIS. There is overhead. As you remember, we have to go through the B-tree directory for every I.O. So, in effect, we're doing two I.O.s for every regular I.O. Now, the I.O. to the B-tree directory, that B-tree directory is normally in cache, so it's going to be fairly quick to go through there, so it's a cache-type hit. Not a whole lot of overhead to doing that, but there is some overhead. So, again, space-efficient VDIS, if your customer wants the highest performance for his database or some particular application, then probably space-efficient VDIS is not the solution for that particular application. Again, with VDIS mirroring, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, a customer could start with space-efficient VDIS, and if he discovers the performance is not adequate, he could use VDIS mirroring to move from space-efficient VDIS to fully allocated VDIS. So it does give you a way to get out of it if you have started with space-efficient VDIS and it's not the most efficient and best performance for a particular application. You are going to want to do as much striping as you can, so just like regular fully allocated VDIS, spindles are important in configuring an SVC environment. One of the fears that we have with space-efficient VDIS is the customer is going to think, hey, I need 20 terabytes of data, but I know those end users are going to use, you know, not even half of that. So I'm going to go out and only buy 10 terabytes of real physical disk. And, oh, by the way, I'm going to go buy the biggest darn disks I can. And now all of a sudden I'm trying to drive more I.O. to a few spindles in my disk back end, and performance is going to suffer. It really has nothing to do with space efficiency or anything. It's just the fact that we don't have enough physical spindles on the back end to handle the workload the customer's trying to drive. So, again, be careful in those environments. You still want to size and plan how many spindles you need in an environment based on the amount of I.O. that is expected in the workload characteristics. But, again, looking at the I.O.s, we mentioned that one directory lookup for every I.O. We could be, in theory, seeing 50% of a normal VDIS. However, since it is cached, it's much less than that, as these other numbers indicate. Typically, you're going to see in a 70-30 type environment, which is what most customers are, that you're going to have to kind of plan to get about 80-85% of the overall I.O.s and megabytes of fully allocated. So if you were looking at our, as an example, our SPC numbers, which show something in, let's just say, 275,000 IOs for an 8-node cluster. If that workload is similar to the customers, we wanted to do it all as space efficient, you would have to drop that down to 80-85% of that number. So there is overhead involved with them. You need to be a little careful with them and plan for them. It does take more CPU. So again, I would encourage that you don't use space-efficient VDIS with the really old SVC nodes, the 4F2 nodes. You probably want to get your customers upgrading off of that older hardware onto the newer hardware, especially if they want to use some of these newer functions. 4.3 does run on the 4F2s, but again, if you want to use these functions, I'd encourage your customers to upgrade to the 8G4 nodes. Let's go ahead and go to the next chart, chart 18. When do you want to use space-efficient VDIS? And we've sort of hinted about that now, but there are some applications where it's just not going to make sense to use these. And this isn't an SVC thing. This is just thin provisioning in general. If you have applications, sometimes databases where they use raw devices and they go out and format, literally write zeros to every location on the disk, you've basically just written to the entire disk and turned a space-efficient VDIS into a pretty much fully allocated VDIS, but you still have the overhead of the space-efficient VDIS because they still do directory lookups. So by doing this formatting that the database may be doing, you know, it's going to take and make the real capacity the same size as the virtual capacity. So in that case, space-efficient VDIS really don't make any sense. One area that you do need to be careful with if you're going to use space-efficient VDIS is on Windows 2008. If your customer does a full format of the VDisk, then in 2008 now, it didn't do it in previous versions of Windows, but 2008 actually goes out and writes zeros to the entire disk, so you've just fully allocated. So you're going to want to do a quick format on Windows 2008 so that you don't basically defeat your purpose for using space-efficient VDIS. We don't really know all the different applications. We didn't test all the different applications or even operating systems to see which ones behave best. We did in our betas, VMware, Windows, AIX, those types of environments, Linux. We had no problems with odd behavior. Again, Windows 2008 being the exception if you do a full format. The bottom line is we really don't know what works well and what doesn't. And, again, the customer is going to have to try it in his particular location to see if it makes sense or not for his particular applications. We go to the next chart, chart 19. Here's just kind of a quick way they can test. You know, if they have an environment, they can create space-efficient VDIS, turn auto-expand off so it can't consume all the physical space, test the application as you implement it to see what it does. Does it use the space efficiently? If it does, then, hey, it makes sense. We can go ahead and turn on auto-expand. We can move the VDisk into production and use it that way. If it doesn't, then we can either delete it and start over, or we could migrate it to a fully allocated VDisk and just decide to use it in the normal way. If we go on to the next chart, chart 20, some interaction with other functions. How does space-efficient VDisk interact with data migrations and flash copies in Metro mirrors? If you remember, it's just a VDisk. So we do most everything at the VDisk layer, so we kind of hide these types of things. So space-efficient VDisk can be created. You can create them as image mode VDisk. You can create them as sequential or striped. It really doesn't matter. Just like you can create a VDisk today, you can do the same things with space-efficient VDisk. Data migration, no different. We migrate a VDisk in all the extents. So now in this particular case, if it's a space-efficient VDisk, we will, and we're going to migrate it, then we only migrate the data. We don't have to migrate all of the extents and all the data to the new location. We move only the data. Flash copy. Now, here it kind of gets a little bit different. If you're using space-efficient VDisk as a flash copy target, and that's what we would do to implement flash copy space efficiency or space-efficient flash copy, we can do that. Now, you can also use a space-efficient target with a fully allocated VDisk and do a something other than a no copy, but then all we're going to do is copy everything from the source to the target, and you're going to turn that space-efficient target into a fully allocated. So that's not a real good use at this point in time. But we can use space-efficient VDisk with a cascaded or incremental or multiple target flash copy functions. Again, that's all done at the VDisk level. And we don't even know that it's a space-efficient VDisk. We can use incremental flash copy, but again, this only makes sense if the source and the target are both space-efficient. Again, as I mentioned, if the source is fully allocated and the target is space-efficient, anything but a no copy is going to end up fully allocating that target, and so it really defeats the purpose of having a space-efficient VDisk. If we go to the next chart, chart 21, we can resize a space-efficient VDisk. Remember, the virtual capacity, what the host sees, we can grow that today just like we do on a fully allocated Windows Basic and Dynamic Disk support growing a VDisk, as does AIX. I believe even Veritas Volume Manager may support that today. So, again, we can dynamically increase the size of the virtual capacity, what the host sees, if the operating system supports it, whether it's space-efficient VDisk or not. Real capacity we can resize as well. Obviously, we can grow it, but we can also shrink it. So if you allocated a 10-gig virtual disk and you had 5-gig of real capacity, and after a year you saw all they ever used was 1-gig used capacity, remember that 5-gig real capacity is pre-reserved, so it's kind of not available for other uses in that managed disk group. We could shrink that real capacity down to maybe 2 gig and put 3 gig of the extents back in the pool for use by anybody else. So you can shrink the real capacity of a space-efficient VDisk without causing loss of data. If you try to shrink it smaller than the use capacity, just SVC won't let you, because then it would destroy some of the data. So we've always had the ability to shrink VDIS, and now it actually makes some sense if we can do that on the real capacity when we talk about space-efficient VDIS. VDISK mirroring, again, since VDIS mirroring sits above space-efficient VDIS, that gives us the ability to actually have a VDIS with two different copy configurations, a way to migrate. We can have a space-efficient VDIS in one copy, and then we could have this, make a second copy that's fully allocated, and then we could delete the space-efficient copy, and now we've migrated from space-efficient to fully allocated. If we try to go the other way, we don't have that capability today. I mean, you can actually do it, but we're going to copy everything from a fully allocated VDIS to a space-efficient VDIS, and so in effect, we're just going to make the space-efficient a fully allocated with just the overhead also then of the B-tree directory and things. So again, you don't want to do that. We don't have zero detect type capability yet. That is planned for a future release where we'll be able to go from what some folks in the industry call going from thick to thin volumes. Metro and Global Mirror, it does work. The problem is, again, when we copy from the primary site to the secondary site, we copy everything. So it's not a real – it's being changed in 4.3.1 as that comes out later this year. But, again, you'll have to look at this. If you start with brand new space-efficient VDIS at the primary and the secondary sites and then write data – at that point in time, we will maintain the space efficiency at both locations. If you have a space-efficient VDIS today and you try to set it up as a metro mirror, it's going to end up copying everything to the remote location, even though it knows it's a space-efficient VDIS at the primary. That's what we're going to address in 4.3.1 to hopefully utilize the space and the space efficiency and preserve that when we do metro and global mirror between locations. Do be aware of performance problems. This may not be something you want to use with Global Mirror, the extra overhead of having to allocate the space, format the space, and write the data is going to have some impact on the latency of IOs, even though they're asynchronous, as you know, with Global Mirror. If things start backing up and we can't get things over to the remote side quick enough, it starts backing up at the production side and could impact performance. Or stop the global mirror, depending on how you have your link tolerance setting in global mirror. So again, be careful with these things. They make sense in some situations, but it may not be the best solution for every application. So let's go to the next chart, chart 22, and let's just take a look at use with flash copy. We kind of talked about these already, so I'll just kind of leave you with this. Basically, we didn't do anything with flash copy. We've just added the ability to use space-efficient VDIS as a source or the target. The only place it really makes sense to use this is if anything other than a flash copy, no copy, is if both the source and the target are space-efficient. If you want to flash existing volumes that are fully allocated to space-efficient targets, you're going to have to use the no copy option, which is a background copy rate of zero on ASVC. A couple of recommendations: if you are going to do a lot of flash copy mappings and you know that ahead of time before you start creating your space-efficient VDIS, the recommendation is to set the grain size that you use for your space-efficient VDIS to be the same as the grain size for your flash copy mappings. The default for space-efficient VDIS is 32 gig, and for flash copy mappings is 256. Again, if you can, if the best performance is to set those both to the same size. If you know you're going to be flashing your space-efficient VDIS, use the same flash copy. Use the grain size that you choose, which is 256 or 64, for your flash copy mappings. Use one of those two for your space-efficient VDIS grain size then as well. Go to the next chart, chart 23. There is one last thing on space-efficient VDIS. You can actually import and export space-efficient VDIS. Now, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. These are actually going to be image mode space-efficient VDIS. What this is really for is if you can move a space-efficient VDIS and preserve the space efficiency if you want to move it from one SVC cluster to another. Don't know too many customers that want to do that, but if you do have a customer that wants to move it, there is a way to do it. You won't really see export and import, but there's a way to migrate it to a space-efficient image mode VDIS. Just like we can today, we can delete the image mode VDIS, take it out from SVC, and present it back to a host natively. Or in this case, since you want to preserve it as a space-efficient VDIS, you would migrate it to another SVC cluster. The B-tree and all that is self-describing. Remember, it's all part of the real capacity on the disk on the back end, and you're going to move that to a new cluster. It will pick up that information and say, okay, this is a space-efficient VDIS, and here's the information, and away we go. So again, let's go ahead. That's really all we have on the space-efficient V-disk. Now let's take a look at V-disk mirroring. This is the other key item in the version 4.3 code. It allows us the creation of two copies of the extents. Again, it's key to know there is only one V-disk. It just has pointers to two different sets of extents on the M-disk. The idea being that we could mirror to two different sets of extents in two different managed disk groups, and those M-disk groups could be on totally different disk controllers. So I could have a copy of the data on one DS4000 and another copy on, say, a DS8000 if I wanted to. Since V-disk mirroring sits below the cache and the replication services, again, it's unbeknown to all of those, it's a global mirror, metro mirror, flash copy, that there is, that the V-disk is mirrored. Remember, we're doing all these copy functions at the V-disk level. The fact that it has pointers to multiple locations is irrelevant. Now, to get V-disk mirroring to work, to be compatible when we do upgrades from previous versions up to the 4.3, we had to set the amount of bitmap space available to V-disk mirroring to zero. So if you try to set up V-disk mirroring initially, you're going to get an error telling you that you need to go out and allocate bitmap space. And what you need to do is go out and allocate, probably going to just allocate what other, a certain amount of space for use for the bitmaps. And this is for synchronization between the V-disk maps. If we would lose one, we keep track of the changes so we can resynchronize without having to copy everything again. You can set this using the change IO group command. There's 512 megabytes of memory available that you can use. You don't want to get too carried away because it steals it from cache on the SVC node. The default for flash copy and metro mirror is 20 meg, so 20 meg is probably a good setting. That will give you up to 40 terabytes per IO group to be able to use for V-disk mirroring. So you can size that. If you need any help, you can always work with us in ATS, and we'll help you size that. We go to the next chart, chart 25. How does IO work? We really read only from one of those two sets of M-disk extents. And you can set this dynamically. So if you have one copy on a DS4000 and one copy on a DS8000, you can set the DS8000 as where we do all reads from. So we'll never read from the DS4000. We'll only read from the DS8000. The only time we'll read from the 4000 if the 8000 is unavailable. We don't do any kind of load balancing or any kind of performance enhancement there. That's just the way it's written for this implementation. You can change it, as we said, on the fly. So if you want to change it to the 4000 because maybe you want to do maintenance on the 8000, that's an option that you can do, and it is dynamic. We go to the next chart, chart 26. As we do writes, now the writes are executed on both copies. So then we're going to write to both the DS4000 and the DS8000. And obviously there's some overhead to doing that, having to write to two locations. However, since this sits below the cache, again, the writes from the applications will come in, and it should not be a performance impact or negligible. However, you do want to be careful if you're going to be mirroring, say, from a DS8000 to, say, a serial ATA disk subsystem. At some point, you may run into a problem where the SATA system is slowing things down and we can't write fast enough to keep up with what's going on say, the DS8000. So, again, you probably want to mirror to fairly similar performing systems. We do keep a bitmap, so if we do lose synchronization between the two sites because maybe we a planned or unplanned outage on a disk controller, we do keep track of that, and then we use that bitmap to only copy the changed data from the source back to that target to get the two copies in sync again. We do everything in 256K grain sizes as well. It actually uses the same function that we do with flash copy today, so you'll see a background copy rate from 0 to 100. You'll see where that helps us as we, too, the whole way this works, that we can do some interesting things with V-disk mirroring. It automatically happens, too, so if you have an outage on one controller, we continue IO on to the other controller. When the other controller comes back online, the system will, SVC will automatically resync the two locations. During that whole time of the outage on one controller, access to that V-disk is maintained and IOs to it continue from the host applications. There will be some delay, just like there would be with any kind of mirroring, as IO is going to that controller. Let's say that the one that failed is the one that is the primary for reads. SVC is going to go through some air recovery, so there will be a pause in the IO for a while for the application. But then once SVC determines that controller is offline or unavailable, it will drive the IO to the other controller and things will continue. Go to the next chart, chart 27. When you create a mirrored B-disk, if you specify format, obviously we're going to copy both, format both copies. I don't know too many people that really format V-disk these days because it just takes so long, but if you need to, that's what it'll do. Otherwise, if you don't do that, one of the copies will be made the primary, and then what it'll do is synchronize the secondary with it. So it'll copy and make sure all of the data is the same on both of them. Now, you do have an option to say, hey, I want you to create both these copies, and they're, say they're already synchronized, even though we haven't done anything to ensure they're synchronized. You can do that. If you know for sure or if you know positively you're going to format it at the host operating system level or you know that there is no previous data on those disks possibly, then you want to be careful doing this because it would be possible you could have data from some previous use of those disks that are now being used by SVC and there's actually data on those physical spindles. So use that with caution. The same when you want to add a copy to an existing V-disk. The default behavior you're probably going to do is the second bullet here is you're going to have the second copy synchronized from the first copy, the original one with all the data, which is what you'd want to do. But you do have an option to say don't do that. I'm not sure why, but you really probably don't want to do that because there may be data on the other volume that you just used that maybe came from another system outside of SVC and there's just data on that spindle and you might get data integrity issues. So again, you're normally going to want to synchronize a new copy with the primary copy. That's the whole purpose for what you're trying to accomplish. You go to the next chart, chart 28, the new commands. You can create these in the GUI or the CLI. Again, remember there's just one V-disk and it has two sets of extents. There's not an ability to have the same V-disk in two different IO groups and things of this nature. It's one V-disk with pointers to two different copies of the data. So you can create a mirrored V-disk, in which case the type you're going to do is going to be the same. So if you're going to create a striped V-disk, then both copies are going to be striped on, let's say, the different managed disk groups that you're going to build the copies on. If you're going to add a copy to an existing V-disk, you can change the structure. So maybe the original copy is a striped V-disk on this managed disk group, and now I want to make it a sequential V-disk on another managed disk group. And, oh, by the way, it's a different extent size in that managed disk group. So you can see where V-disk mirroring can be helpful for several things that we've been limited to in the past. So one of the things you could do is if I had two different extent sizes in my managed disk groups, I could create a second copy of the data on another managed disk group with a larger extent size. And when I get the copy data copied, I could then delete the old copy. And now I've basically moved the data to a new managed disk group with a larger extent size, something we can't do today. So I think you're going to see V-disk mirroring very popular for doing migrations and things because it gives us a lot more control than the basic migration capabilities in SVC previously. If we go to the next chart, chart 29, some other new commands you can do now. You can, the idea of V-disk mirroring was to write to two different controllers so that if one controller went offline, the other controller would still service the IOs from the applications. It also gives you the ability to take a controller offline for maybe planned maintenance. Maybe I have to take it offline to do some particular maintenance on that that controller, such as maybe microcode upgrades on the disks themselves. So now you can do that. If we give you a new command, SVC info LS controller dependent VDisk, that will let you know that if I take controller A offline, what impact is that going to have? Are all of my VDisk mirrored on another controller, or what VDisk will go offline if I would take this controller offline? And so you can use this as a way to make sure that everything is mirrored or moved or whatever so that when you take that controller offline, you're not going to impact applications because their VDisks are going to go offline. So again, it's something to help you with, in this particular case, a planned outage. Migration commands, there is one change there because if you're using the standard migration capabilities in SVC, we move extents. Now you have two sets of extents for VDisk. So when you do the migration of a mirrored VDisk, you have to choose which of the two copies of that VDisk extents do you want to migrate to some other location. Again, with the V-disk mirroring, we can expand and shrink. It works on all copies at once. Don't really do too much shrinking, but if you expand a V-disk, then we'll expand both copies. They'll all be the same size, and they also must be synchronized. If they're not in sync, the two copies you have, and you try to grow a V-disk, it won't let you until the problem is fixed and the two copies are synchronized. And as I mentioned, there's a lot of new commands in the Make V-disk, where there's just as many in the LS V-disk. You're going to see new information. You're going to see information for each copy of the data. So there'll be a lot of new things when you look at those commands in the 4.3 code. If we go to the next chart, chart 30, performance. Again, we don't believe you're going to see too much of an impact. It should be minimal because the cache is going to filter that. Just be careful. If you're going to mirror a V-disk, that you have similar performing physical disk storage behind each of those copies. We make, again, no attempt in the 4.3 code currently to balance reads, so the reads algorithm is only going to look at one of those two copies for all reads. Again, you can dynamically change that. And we also expect synchronization when you're resyncing the copies after some kind of a failure. It's going to be similar impact to the system as flash copy, and again, you can control it by using the sync rate, just like you can with flash copy today. Go to the next chart, chart 31. Now, the big thing I think V-disk mirroring is going to be interesting for is migration capabilities. We have some limitations with migration today in that I can't migrate from one managed disk group to another with different extent sizes. I can't. If I set up my V-disk to be sequential and I want to migrate it to another managed disk group, I can't preserve that sequential. If I set up the starting point of every V-disk to random set things up and I have certain configurations and way I'm striping my extents across the M-disk and the M-disk group and I've gone to that effort, if I try to migrate to a new managed disk group, I couldn't preserve any of that. With V-disk mirroring, I can preserve all of those things and change things if I desire as part of the migration. So I think it's a very powerful utility that customers will want to be using to do some migrations. So as I mentioned, it does give you the ability to migrate between M-disk groups with different extent sizes, which has been a problem in the past, so now I can do that. That's a real easy thing to do, as the steps indicate. I can migrate from space efficient to fully allocated because I can change the type. I can go from space efficient to fully allocated, image mode to sequential mode to striped mode, any combination. I can build that second copy any way I would like. Basically, if you go through the GUI and the wizard, you'll see that you're setting up that second copy just like you would be a new V-disk. So you have all the options available to you. You can control the copy rate of the migration. As I mentioned, it's the same as the flash copy. So I can set it to zero and basically suspend the migration if it's causing some kind of performance impact. Today, when you start a migration from one managed disk group to another, and you set the number of threads, if that has an impact, you can't stop it, you can't do anything, you can't change anything, you just have to wait for it to complete. With V-disk mirroring, using it this way, I can control the copy rate, I can make it go faster, slower, I can stop it, I can suspend it. If I decide I don't want to do the migration, I can just cancel it, something I can't do today. So there's a lot of flexibility and capabilities with the V-disk mirroring to do migrations. As the last bullet even indicates, I can lay it out differently. I can re-stripe how I want things done by moving it to, by creating a second copy. So lots of flexibility. So I really take a look at the V-disk mirroring and the function it provides there. Even if your customer doesn't want to do mirroring to two different controllers, if that's not the need, the V-disk mirroring does offer some very nice utility function that gets the customer to do things he couldn't do in the past. Go to the next chart, chart 32. Let's take a look at a few other things that were also introduced with version 4.3. We do now support IP version 6 addressing, so your customer, if he does need to move to that, can do it. We allow you to use both IP version 4 and IP version 6 together, do your testing, and then delete the older version and move to the new one. So if your customer needs that function, that is now in 4.3. You go to the next chart. In 4.3, we also bumped up the number of V-disks that you can create. Before, it was 1,024 per I.O. group, and you could have up to four I.O. groups for a total of 4,096. Now you can double that, and we now have 8,192 as the maximum, 2048 per I.O. group. We did that obviously for more flash copy mappings that we can do. VDIS mirroring in particular, do note that if you're going to do VDIS mirroring, that every VDIS that is mirrored uses two towards that 8,000 that is available. The reason being is you can actually split off one of those copies and create a whole independent VDisk if you so desire. So that's why we do that. Again, the limit has been increased, basically doubled from previous versions. Go to the next chart, chart 34. We also increased from 16 flash copy targets to 256 flash copy targets. So now you can have lots of points and times for a customer to be able to go back to. This is as we prepare to provide more CDP-like functionality in the SVC, you have these different points and times that a customer could recover to if he so desired. And again, these flash copy targets, these mappings that we can have, they can be, some could be incremental, some could be space efficient, some could be any combination of the above. There's no limits to that. We added auto-delete consistency group because we also added auto-delete flash copy mapping. Previously, this was for some requirements from our brethren in Tivoli for TSM product, but it does give you that ability. And we also then bumped up the number of flash copy mappings to 4,096 as well. Previously, it was somewhere in the 3,000 range, I believe. Okay, if we go to the next chart, chart 35. Some licensing changes, the biggest one being flash copy. Hopefully everybody's already aware of this, but I wanted to reemphasize the fact that we no longer charge flash copy based on source and target. In the past, if you had a two terabyte source volume and you wanted to flash it to a 2 terabyte target, you had to buy a 4 terabyte flash copy license. Now you just have to pay for the source, which is 2 terabytes. And that makes sense. If I had a 1 terabyte database I wanted to flash 256 times, in the past I would have had to buy 257 terabytes of flash copy license. Now I just buy 1 terabyte. So a significant price impact for customers. So this is a good thing. Do note that if you're doing any kind of cascaded flash copy, that where a flash copy target acts as a flash copy source, then it does count towards that source license you need. So in this example here, of A, B, C, D, E. Actually, A is a source, B is a source for the mapping to C, B is also a source for the mapping to D, and D is a source for the mapping to E. So in this particular case, you would need to buy a 4 terabyte license. So just be aware if they're doing, don't find too many people doing cascaded, but if they are, it is anything that acts as a source needs to be counted towards the license, flash copy license that you're going to purchase. We go to the next chart, chart 36. Metromir, GlobalMir license really hasn't changed. I just kind of put it up here so people understand the environment. You do have to, in 4.3, however, list what you're licensed for. Previously, you just checked a box saying, yes, I'm using remote copy functions, Metro GlobalMir. Yes, I'm doing flash copy, and you just checked a box. Now you have to enter the actual terabyte license that you have purchased, and you'll get errors in the error log. If you have these functions available today and you upgrade to 4.3, you'll get errors notifying you that you need to go set those features in the SVC GUI to the license quantity that you have. Do note that in the Metro mirror, you do have to buy for both the source and the target, if you will. So if I'm doing Global or Metro mirror from site A to site B and I want to do 1 terabyte, I need to buy 1 terabyte at each location. If I'm going bidirectionally and I want to do 2 terabyte of source at each location mirrored to the other location, then I need to buy a 4 terabyte license on each cluster. So in this case, we do count the source and the target, if you will, the primary and the secondary disk for MetroMir and GlobalMir, whereas in flash copy, we only do it on the source. Space-efficient VDIS, again, we license on the virtual capacity that the host sees. So if you're creating a bunch of VDIS space efficient that you're going to use for remote copy type functions, then you're going to have to buy the license based on that virtual capacity, even if there's only a very small amount of real used space on that disk. And as I already mentioned, you're going to have to, when you upgrade to 4.3, you're going to have to go in and change some of the licensing things to set your licensing to match what you actually purchased. Not a big deal. Everything will keep functioning. It's just that it's a new settings in 4.3 that you need to set to clear those error logs. Go to chart 37, a couple other neat new things in the code. Helps you know when you're doing upgrades on the SVC cluster in the past. Sometimes you didn't know if something was stopped or stuck or where we were in the process. Now you can get indications of what the status is of the upgrade. Is it inactive? Is it stalled? Are we upgrading, committing? So you get an idea. Plus now on the front panel you can press button combination that will let you know what version of code is running on that particular node. So if you ever get a new 8G4 node and you press the buttons on the front of the panel to display that, it'll tell you that you've got 4.3 is loaded on that particular node. So it gives you an idea of the status of all your nodes when you're doing an upgrade to let you know what, you know, which ones have been upgraded and which ones haven't, if you wanted to look at that to see what's going on in the upgrade process. We go to the next chart, chart 38. We're also providing the ability now for the CE to replace just the SPF or GBIC in the host bus adapter card in the SVC node. In the past, you had to replace the whole card. Now you can do, for diagnostic purposes and things, test those out. And the CE can get those and replace just that component. So that minimizes having to take an outage to replace the card. Note also that we no longer sell a feature code for a master console for the SVC when you're going through eConfig. You have to order, if you want a master console, you have to order the SSPC. You don't have to have an SSPC, so if your customer already has a master console previously and an SVC cluster and he wants to upgrade to 4.3, he doesn't have to buy an SSPC. He can just download the SVC GUI for 4.3 and load it on his existing master console. However, it does require a new version of PuTTY, the .60 version, which is part of the upgrade package, or the customer can download it from the website. That's free software. Still have the issue with NetApp and gateway support for the version 4.3. We hope to address that in the 4.3.1 code, but currently if you have a customer that wants to use a gateway and provide disk to it from the SVC, you do have to get an RPQ for that. So again, continue to submit score RPQs for that type of request. Also, there have been a lot of requests for VMware SRM. That is planned for the end of 2008. It will be supporting MetroMir only initially, and then we hope to support GlobalMir sometime in the first quarter of 2009. So keep an eye on that. If your customers are wondering where the status is, you'll hopefully see in the next month or two that's listed as supported on the SVC website. So the next chart, chart 39, the last thing I really want to talk about is we have changed in 4.3 our statement of support for what we call split clusters, stretch clusters, or split I.O. group. It is required now, and the manuals have been changed to indicate that currently if you want the supported configuration is the SVC nodes, the node and the UPS have to be in the same rack, and the nodes themselves within an I.O. group have to be within 100 meters of each other. So you can't really stretch them too far. Customers now with VDIS mirroring are interested in, hey, I'd like to put one node in an I.O. group in one building and one node in another building across the street or across town. We can consider those kinds of things via the score RPQ. So, again, work with myself, or we can get you also engaged with the development team. We can look at what your customer is trying to do. How could we maybe support it? The big challenge, if you look at this picture, is you'll notice that the nodes have to be connected to the switch. We can't have ISLs between the switches in the two locations for the traffic between nodes in an I.O. group to use. We have to have direct connections to those. We now support long-wave GBICs in the SVC nodes themselves. We've tested, as it's mentioned here on this page, the Finisar model that's listed there. That's not the only one we support. That's just the one we tested. So there are some restrictions, another restriction being that you have to have a third site for the quorum disk because the way the SVC cluster works, the quorum disk becomes a factor in how and what site's going to survive and which one wouldn't and what the recoverability is. So there's a lot to this. If your customer is interested in it, we can maybe work with them to come up with a viable solution and they can understand what the limitations may be. Again, so don't hesitate to involve ATS. Myself in those types of requests. and we'll see if we can help accommodate it. We are doing some more work in this area to try to make this more attractive, the split cluster environment in the future, but SVC was never really designed for that, but we're trying to accommodate it as we go along and add enhancements to be able to do that sort of thing. So again, engage us if you have an opportunity, the customer's really interested in that, and we can see what we can do. Let's go to the next chart, chart 40, and actually that's the end of our presentation. Hopefully we're going to have a time now of question and answers, so if there's anything that wasn't clear, you have any questions on anything particular, we'll be more than glad to answer them. So right now I'm going to turn the call back over to Melody.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. If you are using a speakerphone today, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star 1, and we'll pause for just a moment. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, that is star 1.
So while we're waiting for some questions, do we have any yet, Melody, or we?
There are none in the queue at this time.
He has any questions? Wow, okay. Well, if you do, you know how to get a hold of me, and we can be more than glad to help you out. But in the meantime, I also did want to put in a little plug for some workshops that the ATS group, my team, has been doing that can maybe help your customers get familiar with the SVC. These workshops are really geared for customers who are interested in SVC, haven't quite made the decision yet. It's a one-day hands-on workshop where they can learn about the SVC, get some hands-on with the product, setting up, bringing existing data under SVC and virtualizing it and migrating data and things of this nature. So we encourage your customers to get involved in that. And we have, it is a full one-day session. I'm just trying to look up the schedule. It looks like we have several yet in, we have one the end of October here in Chicago, and then in November there's ones in St. Louis, Bentonville, Arkansas, Seattle, Washington, and then in early December, Los Angeles. So if you have customers in those areas that are looking for some hands-on one-day type workshop to learn more about the SVC, we also have them for TPC if you desire. Just feel free to get a hold of myself, and I'll direct you to more information on that if need be. With that, Melody, we have any other questions?
Ladies and gentlemen, as a final reminder, that is star 1 to ask a question. Ms. Morrison and Mr. Nilchin, your lines are open.
Yeah, I actually tried the star 1. This is Cyrus Nilchin, and I do have a question. It didn't work. The star 1 didn't seem to work for me.
Well, yes, sir, your line is open as a moderator.
Yeah, Cyrus, okay. You're on our call. I tried that myself on a previous, so yeah, it doesn't work. But what's your question, sir?
So my question is basically on slide 35, when you were talking about the flash copy licensing.
Yes, sir.
You said that in your example, you would have to license 4 terabytes of data.
Oh, and I'm sorry. Yeah, that probably should have been 3 terabytes, shouldn't it, now looking at the picture?
All right,
yeah, A is 1, B is acting as a source, and then D is acting as a source. So in that particular case, yes, I apologize, that would be, you'd have to buy a 3-terabyte license there. Good catch. Thank you.
Perfect. Clear it up.
Melody, we have any other questions?
No, sir, there are none in the queue.
Okay, well, again, thank you, everybody, for joining us today. Our next series in the Storage Talk series, our next call is next Wednesday. Cyrus is actually going to be presenting that one. We're going to be taking a look at SVC flash copy and then also the Tivoli products, TSM and copy, advanced copy service, some of the ways to automate backups and things of this nature. So Cyrus will be going into that. So please join us again, and thank you again for today. And I think that's the end of our call. Have a good day.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for your participation and have a wonderful day.